On this episode of Comedy Rewind, how well does Dogma shoulder Kevin Smith's entry into mainstream cinema? Does the religious commentary hold up in 2020? Which lead in this movie had their career basically ruined by an FBI investigation? All of this and more on Comedy Rewind.
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 Push rewind. I thought this was a comedy show.
What's going on, guys? Welcome back to Comedy Rewind. We are powered by Audio Technica as we rewatch the great comedies of the 1990s. I'm your host, Jono Peck, and joining me is the angel of improv, Ben Slinger of Bitstorm, and the angel of grumpiness, Benny McJanet. How are you guys doing?
Good. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, grumpiness is accurate.
Yeah. Most people would be insulted by that, but I think you kind of wear that as like a badge of pride.
I embrace it. It's my own brand. It's my brand now. I'm just like, yeah, I'm the grumpy old man. I don't care anymore.
Keep it going. Yeah. Beautiful. What's the age that you're allowed to be the grumpy old man before you just... Before that, you're just sort of a belligerent kid, you know?
Yeah. I think it's... A lot of people accept me as the grumpy old man now, but like it took a few extra years to just nudge him in the right direction. So
it's the good thing is that it'll suit you more and more as you get older.
Exactly. Everyone says, "Hey, I was a grumpy old man when I was 15." So it's.
Oh man. Anyway, Ben. So we've got Ben and Benny here, which is sure to be confusing. But I thought we might start off with Benny. Have you ever been a Ben? What was the decision to become a Benny? I want to know how that came about.
So Benny was more just a nickname in the internet. Well, not so even so much internet space. Like a few friends would just call me Benny, like as offhand remarks. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, Benny boy and all that sort of stuff. So I never, it was always Ben. I always introduced myself as Ben at work and everything like that. Still, my parents still call me Ben.
Okay.
All that sort of stuff. It's just Benny became more of an internet persona side of things as well, because there are a lot of Bens out there. So I was like, well, I've got to stand out a little bit somehow. So this kind of works for me. Just make it a little bit different, but it's still my
name.
Are
you a Benjamin?
I'm a Benjamin. I assume you're a Benjamin as well. So
I'm a Benjamin.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have to say that at uni, Ben was definitely the most common name.
Oh wow!
On campus, like there was just a million Bennies or Bens. I guess.
Remember in primary school there was one grade. I can't remember what year it was, but there was like four Bens in our grade. And a small
one
country.
Grade, all Bens. Yeah. Just a grade of Bens.
Yeah.
Just throw them all in a room together.
Yeah, small country town high primary school as well. That got confusing fast.
Yeah, that's a lot of Bens for a small school.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm. It's kind of a ageless name. Like some names you hear and you go, oh, that's probably a guy in their 50s. But, you know, a Ben could be a baby, could be an 8-year-old, or it could be someone like you guys.
Yeah.
A bit older. Anyway, speaking of a bit older, we're talking about a 1999 fantasy comedy, Dogma. We're back on the Kevin Smith wagon. And Ben, I think your only appearance so far was Clerks, way back in like episode 3, I think.
Yeah, between Trevor, my co-host on Bitstorm, and myself, where I think we've become your Kevin Smith go-tos, so
yeah, and I thought, happy to be back. Trevor's had a couple other opportunities to jump in, so it's time to get you back on the show. And
this was a good one for that.
So. Yeah, and Benny, I think you've expressed being somewhat of a pretty big Kevin Smith fan too. Yeah. I think both of you and I have thought going into this that this might be our favorite of the Askew Universe movies.
I would argue it is. I was thinking about that today actually. I think this and Clerks 2 are my two favorites of the Viewer Askew.
I was just going to say Clerks. I need to watch Clerks 2 again because I think it might be number one now.
I think it's still
I've
my favorite.
This.
I think yeah, Clerks 2 is still my favorite, but this up until Clerks 2, this was the favorite, definitely. Mm.
Yeah,
I wouldn't have pegged this as necessarily up there before rewatching it, and mostly because I just hadn't thought about like my Kevin Smith top whatever.
Yeah.
but not to get too much into it too quickly, like it held up for me and I sort of remembered how good it was.
Mm.
Yeah.
So I think for my personal memories and experience with this movie, it was, as I've said with the other Kevin Smith podcasts, like when I was in my late teens or early 20s, just like going through and watching all the Kevin Smith movies as I came across them a bit after they came out. This was one that stood out because it felt like a polished Hollywood movie, but it still felt like a Kevin Smith movie, you know, in a way that Mallrats certainly doesn't and that Clerks certainly doesn't. And I guess Chasing Amy was kind of like the in-between movie.
Yeah, Chasing Amy felt more like the sort of typical indie sort of film. Mm.
Yeah.
Still with Kevin Smith's kind of, you know, penchant for crude and sex talk and sex humor. But yeah, I agree that this one definitely felt more polished and more big budget.
Yeah, and it's very much obvious from the not only the cast being like pretty A-list for its time, but also just the way that it's shot. You can tell from like the lenses they're using on the camera compared to You're Chasing Amy and Mallrats. Mm. It just feels like it's a movie that you wouldn't watch it instantly and go, this is a Kevin Smith movie, or it's a independent filmmaker, or it's something that isn't meant to make millions and millions of dollars necessarily.
Yeah, and Chasing Amy opened a lot of doors for this film as well, because and it's on record, Alan Rickman and Chris Rock, and I think there was a few of the other cast as well, all literally wanted to be in this movie because of Chasing Amy. Like I think Kevin Smith tells the story where he says, oh, we heard Alan Rickman was a fan of Chasing Amy, so we sent him the script, and the only question he had when he asked about it was, are you going to cut any of this? Because he loved the script so much, he didn't want any of it to be cut out. So, it was kind of cool that that's how this all came about.
Really. I think there was two questions. The other one was, are the wings like...
Oh, yeah, are the wings digital CGI or real? Yeah.
Yeah, so Ben, being I think a bit older than, well, definitely older than me, do you have recollection, like did you watch this movie as it was out at the cinema or did you wait for it to cut into DVD?
So, in between, I took down some notes before I started watching of sort of what I remembered, and one of the main things was, this was the first Kevin Smith movie that that came out after I kind of got into Kevin Smith.
Mm-hmm.
So the others I'd sort of come across through probably VHS at the time or different means. But this was the first one I saw where I was sort of following his work. So mm-hmm. I had a little bit of buzz around it. I'm not sure why I did this, but it may have been that it was a way to get it earlier. But I downloaded a cam, a bad cam rip of this over dial-up.
That was going to say, in early 2000 or late 99, that would have taken a long time.
Yeah, you just reminded me that, 99 would have been dial-up. Oh,
it
God.
Probably took about a week.
Yeah.
I do recall having, you know, the old FTP servers with resume on to make sure that it would pick up after any disconnections. So, that's actually how I first watched it. I'm not sure I actually ever saw it at the cinema. But definitely then, you know, grabbed it on DVD later and watched it many times with commentary tracks and this sort of thing.
Yeah, right. And what was your initial thoughts at that time? Do you remember?
I was pretty into it. I don't recall it being sort of a blow me away moment, but mm-hmm. it was more Kevin Smith, right? It was more of his work to enjoy. So, like I said, I wouldn't have picked it necessarily as one of my favorites coming into it. And I do wonder if it's now that it's more, that it holds up more because it is sort of that more of a big budget film and more of a, you know, a sci-fi fantasy kind of thing that it holds up as my older self rather than my 18-year-old self.
Mm. Okay. Yeah, I think the thing that I liked about it was that it was a bit more high concept than the other stuff. Having obviously this fantasy or sci-fi element, being like a Christian myself and having all this mythology and imagery and lore, I guess, in there made it quite interesting and kind of challenged some of my thinking about things. And we'll probably get into it a bit later. You know, there's obviously a lot of liberties taken with the theology and stuff that doesn't Benny's got the Buddy Jesus set up as his background there. I love it. There's a lot of stuff that like Kevin Smith's just using complete creative license with, but at the same time he does hit on some really like important commentaries, I think, about organized religion or about the people that have taken Christianity or Catholicism and kind of run with it in the wrong direction. So I think that that is something that I enjoyed, despite, you know, I guess some people would say it's blasphemous, but we can get into all that later. Did the religious element of this for you guys hit in any particular way the first time you saw it? Because it is quite a unique thing about this movie, I think, and an area that most films wouldn't dare to tackle, because obviously it was quite a controversial thing at the time.
Yeah, I don't recall many other comedies, especially, not many comedy films based with a religious overtone for the
Life of Brian.
Life of Brian is probably the only one that really comes to mind. Like, there aren't a hell of a lot, especially in that late 90s, early 2000s period. I was actually baptized Catholic and everything as well, so I've had a bit of that Catholic upbringing myself. And even, like, I never really been a strong practicer of religion or anything like that, but watching this, it did make me question my faith. And I think that's something that I think a lot of people should do every now and then, is just question their faith and what they believe in. And as Chris Rock brings up in one of his parts, is to, like, having a better idea of what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Or what is happening, rather than having blind belief in something, works better. And I agree with that sentiment that's brought up in the movie. It's brought up a couple of times. And I really, that really resonated to me as someone who doesn't necessarily identify as Christian or Catholic, but has that background to their life.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah, whereas I wasn't brought up religious at all, and have never practiced a religion, but and actually thinking about it now, that may have been one of the things at that age that that made it a bit difficult to get into, because there's some sort of dense Catholic lore in there that he draws upon for absolutely the main plot. And, you know, I don't know if someone who's grown up with that with those stories and some of that history would sort of that would make more sense with them, and it makes more sense for them, and kind of that those that it would be familiar enough that, you know, all the sort of talk about you know, God's infallibility, and you know, that what happens on earth will be held true in heaven, and this sort of thing. And and I think at the time that actually maybe made it a bit hard to even follow what was going on when I was originally watching this. I didn't find it as much of an issue this time. And maybe that's just because of, you know, I've learned more, understand more about it. I've also listened to Kevin Smith talk a lot about his experiences with religion and how this was, you know, this movie was obviously him, you know, working through certain ideas with his religion and exploring that. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think you bring up a good point. Like, in a way that a lot of Kevin Smith movies are just full of pop culture references, this one almost replaces them with, like biblical references and stuff like that, which maybe I appreciate, like, when he's talking about, like, you know, what happened in Egypt with the Angel of Death and that kind of thing, instead of just, like, talking about Star Wars and Lord of the Rings or whatever. So, yeah, that does make it stand out, I think. And, Ben, you'll probably know more about, like, I guess, the backstory to this movie coming together, but from what I gather, it was his first movie that he wanted to make, but obviously didn't have the budget to make it work in the way that you could with something like Clerks. It's a bit more simple, right? And it was also intended to be, like, the first follow-up to Clerks, because at the end of the credits, it says that Jay and Silent Bob will return in Dogma.
Yeah, I believe that was the case. It's been a while since I listened to the commentary tracks and such to remember that sort of trivia. I don't have the Bear Trap mind that Trevor does for trivia, but that's all right. I do recall that this was definitely one of his earlier ideas, and it took this long to sort of gain enough respect and you know, ability in the industry to pull together what he needed to make it.
Yeah, and he really did a great job. Like, the cast of this movie, it's probably more impressive now than it was at the time, with especially with, like, Matt Damon and Ben Affleck becoming, like, two of the biggest box office draws of the last 20 years, I guess. But we'll get into that a bit later. For now, do you want to guess what the Rotten Tomatoes score would be for this movie? We'll start with Benny.
I'm going to say it's in the 60s, probably. Let's just say 64, random guess.
Sure. Ben?
I'm going to go with 71.
So it was 67, ooh, which puts you within 3, Benny. I feel like you've had some pretty decent guesses over the past episodes, but that's a good one.
I was going to say 69, but then I didn't want to be crude, but it would have got me closer, so I should have.
It's Price is Right rules anyway. So
So, a budget of $10 million, which isn't a lot for a movie like this. Like, it's surprisingly low, especially when you consider Chris Rock, Salma Hayek, and, as you mentioned, Alan Rickman. Like, three very well-respected actors in their fields, and that's not even including Affleck and Damon, who I guess they're friends of Kevin Smith, so it's kind of mates rates, I suppose.
Well, they all did it to scale, apparently.
Yeah, which is kind of a really interesting thing about the movie. It made $44 million, which makes it the highest grossing film in the series, like the Viewers' Universe series. Not a lot of money. It's funny how, like, much cultural impact Kevin Smith has when his movies have never really made that much money.
Mm. Yeah, he's almost the definition of sort of the cult filmmaker in that way, that he has such an audience and so many people know who he is, but for whatever reason that just doesn't translate to box office.
To going to the movies, yeah. It'd be interesting to look at, I guess, DVD sales and that kind of thing, because I feel like it would, like, be double and triple times over.
Yeah, I mean, and he obviously makes enough to live pretty comfortably, you know. He's not a struggling filmmaker by any means.
I'd definitely say it's all in, like, video sales, like, after the fact, because especially in those early 2000s, and, like, DVDs were big back then and all that sort of stuff, like renting the DVDs or buying DVDs, especially in the late 2000s too, like, that's when JB Hi-Fi took off here in Australia because of all the DVD and CD sales and things like that going on there. So, and everyone had big DVD collections. I still got a box of DVDs in the corner here.
You can see mine behind me. I've just
there you go. So, like, just from collecting in those days, whereas now I don't buy anything really physical. No. The director or the video home video sales back then definitely would have made up a huge share of his market.
Yeah.
Because I know so many people, and it also speaks to the type of films that he would make as well, but like the stoner comedy side of things for him as well, because back in my stoner days, in those early 2000 periods, a lot of my friends and myself, we would watch these movies on repeat and reciting the same jokes over and over and over again.
Yeah, that's the effect that Jay and Silent Bob have on
100%.
People.
100%.
Yeah. So I've got a comment here from Empire magazine when it came out saying, Smith's comic allegory is overlong and confused, but his move from indie to mainstream deserves at least some credit. And I think we've kind of touched on both of those ideas. So we'll move on to the number one song when this movie released. I usually make people guess this, but it's so hard, so we'll just shoot through it. And in the US, it was Smooth by Santana in November of 99. And then a few months later in Australia, it was actually in February year 2000, and Killing Heidi was at number one with Mascara. Bit of a throwback.
And there you go. Wow. That's why I had to download a copy, because we weren't getting it for another 3 months.
Yeah. That explains everything. What Have You Done For Me Lately? Ben Affleck had The Way Back, which was like a basketball movie coming out in, I think, March. Probably one of the last movies to get a cinematic release.
He was Batman.
He was Batman. But, you know, that wasn't lately. That was... when was he last Batman? It was probably
a couple of years ago.
Yeah,
but still, I mean, that's pretty recent.
I guess, yeah.
He's being replaced now.
Yeah, there's a new Batman.
There's already a new Batman.
Matt Damon has a movie coming out either later this year or early next year called The Last Duel, which is a Ridley Scott movie with Adam Driver about, like, the last medieval duel, I suppose. So I'm looking forward to whatever that ends up looking like. I think he and Affleck had a go at the screenplay, adapting a book. Obviously, Jay and Silent Bob reboot has been out late last year / early this year, depending on which part of the world you live in. I still haven't seen it. I know that you guys
I haven't seen it.
Oh, you haven't?
No. I know Ben and it's one of those ones because the way they released it, where they just went from town to town releasing it, it's like, I get what you're trying to do, but can you just release the movie? Because it's just kind of giving me a shit now.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing that Kevin Smith has done a few times, and I agree, especially for us in Australia, because he never makes it down here.
Mm-hmm. I don't even know if Reboot was even in the cinemas here at all, to be honest.
I don't know.
I doubt it was.
So anyway, I still haven't seen it. I think last time you were on here, Ben, you were about to check it out, or it was coming soon.
Yeah. Yeah, Trevor and I watched it, and both Matt Damon and Ben Affleck. I think Matt Damon was in it.
Yeah.
I'm always certain. But, yeah, it was okay.
Interesting enough, I did a little bit of research, and I think this was the last movie that Affleck and Damon did together as, like, the lead roles. Like, obviously, Good Will Hunting was a big one. I think they did some comedies together in the mid to late 90s. But this was the last time that they were both in the same movie. I wonder if people couldn't afford to get them together after this.
Oh, they were in Jay and Silent Strikes Back together.
They were, but they weren't.
There was a cameo,
like,
role, but yeah.
It was their Good Will Hunting, like...
Good Will Hunting 2.
Yeah.
Hunting season.
Well, and amusingly, this was really before they both become kind of more action stars at that point. Mm-hmm. More so Damon than Affleck, I guess, although obviously with Batman and other things, Affleck's done a lot of action sort of stuff too. Why, like, there needs to be an action reunion of them together. They need to be in an action film together. Like, I feel like that would...
It'll be like Expendables 12 or something.
Yeah.
With them and like, Vin Diesel and whoever else.
The Rock.
The Rock.
And they work so well off each other as well. They really should do something else again. I know it's kind of pigeonhole casting for that sort of thing, but yeah, they do work well. I think
they should have brought Matt Damon on as a Robin.
Yeah.
In the Batman series.
Well, you can't really do that because he's actually older than Ben Affleck.
But he's got more of the baby face of him.
But it was actually, you just reminded me about them being together, and that was one of the things I think that's turned me off watching this when it first came out, because I would have been 16 when this came out in the States. Was because it was around that same time that Good Will Hunting came out. It was like, oh, it's just a Ben Affleck, Matt Damon movie. Because they're on the cover of the poster and everything like that. Yeah. It's just like, oh, and they're angels. Okay, this is just another Good Will Hunting movie. And it wasn't until later that I realized, oh, it's a Kevin Smith film and it's related to Clerks, blah, blah. That's when I actually went and watched it.
All right. Well, Salma Hayek had a movie come out earlier this year called Like a Boss. Didn't do so great, but she gets credit for actually releasing a movie in the year of the coronavirus. Chris Rock just hosted SNL, and he's in the upcoming The Witches movie, I think. Is it a movie or a TV show?
It's a movie, and I think he's the narrator?
Yes. Yeah, that sounds right.
With Anne Hathaway. I didn't see him in the trailer, but I heard his voice.
And then the female lead of this movie, Linda Fiorentino, has done nothing since 2009. And I don't know if you know much about her, but there's a really weird story where she was, like, accused of... This is, like, she was apparently dating an FBI agent that was getting investigated for accessing information and giving it to her for a screenplay about a criminal that she was actually with. And then, like, trying to use the information to get him out of his, like, 15-year jail sentence. Really weird.
Wow.
Footnote in her, like, Wikipedia page. And there's nothing really official about why she's not working anymore. So I wonder if it's related to that.
Witness protection.
Crazy.
Yeah,
story.
Who really knows? But she was in Men in Black in the 90s, and that was probably, like, her big role that I can think of. And then, yeah, she kind of seemed to be popping up here and there, and then suddenly just, like, never again. So, bit of a weird one. And apparently not very fun to work with, according to Kevin Smith.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I definitely heard, you know, after this film came out, was that they had creative differences, to put it mildly. And that, like, some days she just wouldn't even talk to him.
Yeah.
Yeah. You never know without being there sort of how that sort of thing comes about, but also knowing, you know, how sort of laid back Kevin Smith is, it's hard to imagine him creating beef, so who knows?
Yeah, according to the stories that he tells, it's like she wasn't happy that other actors were allowed to leave when they weren't having shoots. Like, if they had some days off, they were allowed to go from the place that they were filming back to New York or LA or whatever. But she was filming so much that she couldn't, and she got hissy about it. And then apparently she didn't like the poster because Matt Damon and Affleck were in the middle, and that's, like, obviously his side of the story. But then apparently after his heart attack or something, I think she called him and he, like, apologized for all the things that he said about her quite openly, as he does.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess we can let her off the hook.
Close the book on that, yeah.
Yeah.
What a he said, right. She said, really.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, she didn't really say... She hasn't really given her side, so it's just pretty much he said.
Yeah.
He said. And he says a lot, so...
Yes, he does.
Okay. What's the most 90s moment of Dogma, Ben Slinger?
I was surprised at how few things there were, actually, in this.
This was a tough one.
Really made it clear that it was the 90s. For me, it was just that the Little Demon Kids were on rollerblades. That is definitely sort of a definitive 90s, you know, trend for me. But yeah, that was really all I came up with.
Yeah, it was definitely a tough one. Did you have anything, Benny?
I mean, there's a few references that are very more 90s than today, I suppose, but not so much.
Yeah,
anything that's really critically outstanding. Like, you look at the TV in the bar and stuff, like, whenever they're watching the TV, it's always an old TV. The way that they were in the airport, that's not what American airports are like these days.
That's true. You probably couldn't just sit around and watch people...
Yeah, get on and off planes. You know, yeah. I don't know what they were like in the 90s, so I've got nothing to compare it to.
It's a very pre-9/11.
When I was over there, that's not how American airports are like. Yeah, so those are the few things that really were pretty... Oh, catching a bus, really. I mean, I think that's something that still happens in America to go cross-country, but it's not really something that would happen so much here in Australia.
Yeah, I don't think there's a lot of, like, interstate bus travel here.
Not anymore.
But, yeah.
I mean, I used to catch the bus from Canberra to Sydney to go see bands and stuff like that.
Mm.
But that's because I was a tight ass and things like that as well. But, it's just little things that were very 90s. No one had a cell phone or anything. That's probably the other thing.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Internet really wasn't brought up at all in the film. So it's not so much that it's the 90s reference stuff. It's stuff that we take for granted now isn't in the film.
Yeah, I think being, like, 1999, it doesn't really have a bunch of that, the classic 90s fashion and the kind of thing that we would associate with the decade.
Yeah.
And then if you look at a movie like American Pie that came out in 99, that's to do with teenagers who are on the latest trends and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it doesn't even really have that to deal with. It's a bit more timeless in the sense that, you know, they're wearing hoodies and no one's really... rocking an undercut or anything.
Yeah, the one thing that doesn't really surprise me, though, that isn't... It's, like, something that at time hasn't changed in America is when they're in the gun shop and they're talking about, like, oh, this doesn't strike... It doesn't have that wrath of God feel about it, you know?
Yeah.
They're openly talking about committing murder in front of this gun shop owner, and the gun shop owner just doesn't give a shit. I mean...
Yeah, that's probably only got...
That's just very American,
so,
I think.
As well. Yeah.
Yeah, for this one, the only thing I had was the John Hughes references, where even though they're 80s movies, they're talking about them in a way that's like they've watched them 1,000 times, which is more of probably a 90s thing.
Yeah, that would definitely that would definitely come across as a lot more kind of idiosyncratic these days if you were super into 80s John
Lewis. Yeah, it would be a bit more unusual. It would be more likely that you'd be talking about Kevin Smith movies and let's go to the town that all the Kevin Smith movies take place in, New Jersey.
Jersey, it'd be the opposite. So.
And like the quick stop does exist, so it's a bit different. But anyway, that was the thing that struck me, and I guess the fact that Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, like their appearances, their appearances together, like if you see them standing next to each other, like it just feels like the late 90s to me.
They look like so however young many too. Magazine covers,
before the billions and billions of box office dollars that came since. So what did you guys have for the most iconic scene in Dogma?
It's such a toss-up.
Yeah, I found this tricky. I've got a few noted down kind of as I was watching it in order.
Sure. Give us the top three.
Top three. All right. I'll give you top three. So first was just the introduction of the Metatron. Alan Rickman's first appearance. It's just very memorable, you know, putting out the flames, turning the baseball bat into a fish.
No genitals,
exactly. Yeah. I do have that noted down. the big, you know, the giant wingspan appearance. I don't want to step on Benny's. I'll let Benny do one before I do any of others.
A couple of scenes with Loki, like Matt Damon as Loki, talking to the nun in the airport at the start.
Mm.
Convincing her basically that religion isn't real by going through talking about through the looking glass.
It's a very Kevin Smith.
It is very dialogue. Kevin Smith.
Yeah,
but like just the delivery that Matt Damon and just his sheer belief in what he's doing as well just comes across really well on that scene. The scene again on the like these are just the ones that really stuck in my head. From just remembering it before I even rewatched it, I was like, I remember this scene. And it was like the movie office, the massacre,
the boardroom scene. I had that written down too.
That was my number two.
That's got to be one of the most, like if you talk to someone about Dogma, that's one of the scenes that everyone I think remembers the most. But
it's got such a good sort of up and down to it as well. Because
It's
there's Matt Damon in there just like trying to be super dramatic, and then you know Ben Affleck's Bartleby just like constantly undermining him, and screwing up his flow. But just ending obviously on the huge massacre.
You didn't say God bless you when I sneezed. there's another one that always comes to mind is the scene underneath in the car park towards the end.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the one line is like, I've heard a rant like this before. Like you sound like the goddamn like Morning Star.
Yeah.
Like that just, I don't know what about that scene just sticks in me. Like, I just remember it really well.
It's
I don't know if there's any others.
It's very stark. It comes across as just,
it's one of the few that's feels out of place in the movie, but it's right for the movie, and it just sticks in the back of my mind constantly.
So the other one that I had was when they're all on the train, and when Bartleby and Bethany are talking and they're getting drunk together. Well,
he's pretending to get drunk.
Yes. Yeah. Bethany's getting very drunk, and just the dramatic tension of the audience obviously knowing that, you know, one is essentially hunting down the other or you know, trying to that they're going to the same place for the same reason, and seeing Ben Affleck, seeing Bartleby come to that realization as she starts talking after they've had a really like sort of nice friendly scene where they're getting to know each other and obviously enjoying each other's company. That one really sort of struck me as
really it's a kind of Tarantino-esque kind of tension, isn't it?
Going into the strip club's another one. Serendipity.
It's a fun moment, like the musical the musical side of it, and Kevin Smith kind of pulling out the, you know, the money.
His little shimmy,
the little Jackson 5 thing that Jackson 5.
The little ding as each one each side brings out more and more money.
So, interestingly, something that hasn't been mentioned, it's the first one that I wrote down. I wrote this one down before watching the movie, was the poop monster.
Yeah, well, yeah.
For some reason, that was, like, the first thing that I thought of with Dogma. It's so ridiculous. Mm. It's probably the point that a lot of people might have, like, turned the movie off if they were watching it on TV. But, yeah, I feel like Kevin Smith has to throw in some poo jokes.
Yeah, in a movie like this. You know, at least it sort of had some, still called back in some way the whole Golgothan idea. Yeah, but it's pretty gross.
Yeah. All right. So, on that note, what holds up the best?
Yeah, well, on that note, I wrote down that actually the special effects in general hold up pretty well for a movie of this time. I think mostly just because he used practical effects in a good way. There's obviously some CG in there, but relatively minimal and just sort of where needed. So I felt that in general quite good. You know.
The wings. What do you think of the wings?
Yeah, well, again, using practical effects for that, they look great, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it didn't look so great when they were flapping like once every like 5 seconds and they were still staying in the air. But I guess that was just like, I don't know, the way that they had to do it.
Yeah, it's probably hard to create that sort of realistic effect. And again, that was the CG. Like the CG itself, if you recognize those moments, you can probably tell it's, again, of the time.
Yeah.
There were a few moments that were reminiscent of like the special effects in like the Harry Potter films whenever they were trying to create like a recreation of a person, right? It must have just been that the level of fidelity that they could do at that time, it sort of becomes obvious.
I think just the CG was so few and far between. Like there wasn't a hell of a lot of the CG stuff.
Yeah,
it was so much more practical that like the special effects actually do hold up pretty well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I thought it worked well, like when they had the wings removed and then you could see like with Bartleby, the nubs of the wings were still like moving around, kind of twitching, which was a cool little kind of like motorized
setup. And when they're shooting it something. Off, like the squibs going off and things like that, and it actually looked really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just used it where needed. Like, we haven't talked about him yet, but Azrael's horns appearing for the first time but then they're practical, right? Then they're stuck on there after that. So just very using it very minimally. I was gonna say I wish he'd kept this use of CG into the future, because I don't know if you guys have seen Yoga Hoses yet.
No.
Which is one of his most recent ones. It was okay.
I saw the one with the walrus, and that was just like, Kevin, I'm sorry. I'm trying here, man. I'm really trying. Yeah. I can't get into this film.
This is the follow-up.
I didn't want to see Yoga Hoses after that.
This is the follow-up. It's not quite as over-the-top strange as that, but it does have these little... And I'm going to completely like undermine what I just said. It does have these little sausage Nazis.
That's why I was like, sorry, man, you've lost me. I'm gone.
But he uses a lot of CG for those sausage Nazis in Yoga Hoses, and it is not good CG. And I just feel like it would have been so easy to just squish some real sausages and use practical effects. But in Dogma, they made good use of it.
Benny, did you have anything different for this question?
No, not really. I mean, we've pretty much covered it all, I think.
Yeah.
It's just, just the practical effects, I think, were, like, it suits a lot better. And I'll still stick to this whenever it comes up, is basically practical effects definitely work a lot better than a lot of CGI effects. Use CGI where it's needed, but sometimes the practical just works 10 times better.
Yeah, I guess it's interesting to think, like, Phantom Menace came out the same year as this, which is obviously chock full of, I guess, a mixture of practical and digital, but mostly digital.
It was
and,
mostly digital because that Yoda in there, like they tried to make a young... Originally, it was a puppet, I think, originally for Yoda. And they tried to make a younger version of the puppet. Like if you go look at some of the old screen grabs of it, it did not look anything like Yoda. So that's when they CG'd it in for the, I think, for the DVD releases or something like that.
But I think Jar Jar was like
Jar Jar was practical. 100%. He was CGI, but basically Ahmed Best was on set with a Jar Jar head stuck to his head.
Okay. See, I thought he had like an outfit and then it was just his head that was animated with the weird hands.
It was basically him in an outfit. But they used that outfit as a template for where Jar Jar was going to be. And they CG'd the whole character over the top.
Cool. All right. Well, moving on from Star Wars.
Sorry.
I think what held up the best for me was some of the theological critiques that we've mentioned already. Mm. Not like it's more like this, there's a lot of stuff in here that's for dramatic effect, like the technicalities of how to get into heaven and this kind of stuff that. There's really like no foundation for that, at least in my belief system.
No.
Like you can't like outsmart God. Like it doesn't really work like that, or like capture him inside like
a guy. I think that proves the point that God is infallible. So
yeah, and then like the way that that whole side of things. Like if you were to show this to a theologian, they'd say like that kind of falls apart there. But in saying that, the commentaries that are running throughout the movie with kind of monologues from both Loki and Bartleby talking about how the way people have turned away and twisted this great thing and turns it into something that's terrible, being like, you know, the corruption within the church and the way that we haven't mentioned him yet, but... may he rest in peace, George Carlin. His character's
the cardinal
commercialization of church and, you know, sweeping the sins of the past under the rug. I think that's become way more pertinent with everything that's come out about the Catholic Church since this movie came out, with obviously the abuse scandals and that kind of thing. That only makes it kind of more relevant over the past 10 years or so. And like you mentioned as well, Benny, this monologue from Chris Rock's character Rufus talking about like people get caught up in their beliefs without going back to the reason that they believe in that, the idea behind it.
I like the line, it's easier to change an idea than a belief.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, and like the movie's called Dogma because of that reason. Like it's... things that are believed without any questioning or investigation just because that's what you're told. It's like supporting a football team because your dad supported the football team, or like I support Donald Trump because I don't know why you support
because I'm a Republican. And
exactly. So I think that holds up really well, and that's something as someone with faith I encourage people to question things that they believe and come to.
I think it's good to question everything.
The right answers,
It's 100% good idea to question everything in life: church, politics, education, science, fact, fiction. Yeah. It's always a good idea to question everything, because if you're not questioning things, you're not learning, you're not growing as a human being. And I think that's very important that we all should do. And I think that's why I think more people of faith and people not of faith should watch this particular film as well, because it makes you question it. And hopefully when people finish watching a film like this, if they can stomach some of the, you know, the poo monsters and
masturbation jokes
and Jay's foul mouth, you know, they can walk away with it and go, and they can actually start asking those questions of themselves. Okay, what do I believe in? What do I think about this? How do I feel about these sorts of things? And they can make up their own minds then and have a better idea of the world around them. And I think that's one of the good things about this film.
It's interesting. Definitely. It's interesting, actually, you know, you're talking about... You know, I was just thinking of this as, you know, Dogma as the title, and sort of dogmatic law is what creates the whole loophole that they're trying to get through. But then you do have these characters sort of, I guess, and obviously just the film itself and its commentary on religion... treating it all a bit more loosey-goosey in that, you know, it's an idea, it's not a belief, like, making it a bit more personal, I guess. And you know, even when God herself shows up at the end, in that she's just this very sort of whimsical character then, and it's hard to see the kind of hard-ass Old Testament god that Loki and Bartleby have been talking to and were familiar with
the whole film,
Throughout the whole film. So yeah, it's interesting how the film does sort of demonstrate both those sides of it simultaneously.
I mean, and they even say it right at the start of the film in the disclaimer, it's like God must have a sense of humor, and like look at the platypus, and I'm still a little bit hurt about the disparaging remarks made about our beloved platypus here in Australia, but you know, it's I'll live with it, I'll move on.
He does apologize for that in the second disclaimer. So
he still called it stupid in that apology. So,
very good. Okay, so what holds up the worst? I'm going to go first. The rollerblade demons. I just don't know why they're in the movie, apart from that you have to have rollerblades in a Kevin Smith movie, I guess, in the 90s.
It was just Azrael needed some little minions.
Henchmen.
Let's put these minions on rollerblades for some reason.
The makeup was good. They look pretty, you know.
The thing I don't get about them is that they're demons and they can tear a portal through time and space and kill someone with a hockey stick. But then Jay and Silent Bob, like, beat them up. What? Like, that doesn't make any sense.
They clearly weren't super powerful demons. I'm minor demons. Because... maybe it's just Azrael could only afford so much help as part of his plan.
Yeah. Yes.
That's why he got a shit demon and he didn't get a good demon.
Yeah, that's the other part of it as well, is Azrael as a character, like, he has a really important role in the plot, I guess, but then he doesn't show up for the last act. And I just kept, like, as I reflected, I was like, why wasn't he part of that scene at the church? Like, why wasn't he having to face God as well? Like, it seemed like that loop, that kind of C plot, wasn't really closed. Am I missing something there?
I mean, he gets killed by Bob.
He gets killed?
So yeah, that's probably the only closure. When he hits him with the golf
clubs,
he dies.
Right.
Or he goes back to hell, I guess.
Right, okay, sure. Yeah. So I guess I didn't add that up, but that does make sense, you're right.
So that's why he's at the end. But I do agree, like, Azrael's very minor plot in the film, just, yeah.
Yeah, that scene in the bar, they kind of treat him, you know, he has a big monologue and he sort of has his, he's a trickster and he was the one who's, you know, who's sort of orchestrated it all.
Yeah.
But it doesn't sort of hold up to his general role in the movie because, what did he do? He sent a newspaper article that was pretty much real. Like, and then obviously he's sending his minions off to, you know, antagonize people. But
yeah, God in the hospital, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
But like, he didn't really do that himself. Like, you're right. I found like, and it, like the ending where it's just like, he's like, well, I don't care if I make existence. I just want it to end. I'm over it. I don't care. I was like, that's kind of... I mean, I guess I can't relate, but at the same time, it's like, it's kind of a shitty motivation.
Yeah.
Like, you just, like, I just want everything to end. Like, that kind of sucks. I mean, it's the go back to the Dark Knight. It's like, oh, some people just want to watch the world burn. I was like, well, he doesn't really want to watch the world burn. He just wants everything to end. He's over it. So I was like, well, there must be another way you could do that. Like...
Yeah, it did sort of feel like he was just there
for
the gag about the priest's golf clubs and that he'd be the sort of guy to bless his own golf clubs.
The holy bartender joke, and that was about it.
Yeah.
The air conditioning, yeah. The other thing I had was, like, you've got this scene where Loki and Bartleby have, like, massacred a huge crowd of people and, you know, all the chaos that's happened there. And then I guess there's the whole climax with God and with Jay and Silent Bob and with everything. Through that whole time, there's no cops there. It's like the whole point was to draw police there to kill him after he comes out of the church, but all this chaos happens and there's not a police officer to be seen.
Their response time is pretty lackluster, isn't it?
Yeah. I guess it's more of a nitpick than what holds up badly, but I just thought I had to throw that out there.
It's a bit of a plot hole.
Yeah. Anyway, that's all I want to say for this one. Did you guys have something holding up poorly?
Going back to that sort of plot hole thing with the police not showing up, less so much with the movie thing. Like, a little bit with the movie thing is, like, it's not referenced again after the massacre in the boardroom. Like, there's no mention, like, because they've got the news reports pumping up and it, or, like, things, and there's no mention of, oh, there's this movie massacre or anything like that. That's not mentioned again for the rest of the thing. Also, that when he kills the guy on the bus, and, like, they all come running and screaming off the bus, and then they just start walking off, and, but it's like, there's nothing, like, no cops turning up or anything to that or anything. No, like, where did these people run off to? Like, there's no...
And they still have to get across the country, so...
Yeah, what? It's, it just... I don't know, there's just something about that just seems
drive
to
the
me
bus,
from a plot hole point of view. Like, just jump in the bus and drive it to your next destination. Don't you know how to drive? You've been on Earth for millennia.
Yeah.
I would have figured you'd picked up on how to drive a freaking car at this stage, let alone a bus, so, yeah.
Yeah. No, I'll give you points for that.
Ben? I didn't have too much. I did sort of note... just along the lines of what I said earlier, just the density of some of the church lore and the way that it's necessary to make the plot fit together can just be a bit hard to follow, I think, particularly the first time you watch it. But, you know, like I said, I didn't find that as bad this time. The only other thing that maybe doesn't hold up as well today is there's just some... slightly homophobic jokes in there. It's hard to tell with the, like, the intent is not pure, you know,
it's no
gay panic kind of homophobia, but just around, you know, when the talk of the Chris Rock's character, you know, announces that Jay masturbates to guys when he jokes off or whatever, and the shock around that and that sort of thing. So I don't think it was, it certainly wasn't malicious. It was just more that it was played for laughs.
I think the shock of it is more that, like, that's not the image that Jay presents.
Yeah.
It goes against his, like, persona as being, like, a ladies crusher or whatever.
Exactly. So that was not major at all, but it just sort of stood out a little. But no, that's all I had.
Yeah, okay. So, if we're going to ask who would be most offended, I feel like the obvious answer would be, like, probably Catholics. People that maybe don't have a sense of humor about their beliefs.
Yeah, well, there was a Catholic organization that was protesting the film back when
it
first
came out. It was the Westboro Baptist Church.
Oh, really? Was it the Westboro Baptist Church?
I think it was the Westboro Baptist Church.
I don't think it was. It was a different mob.
I feel like I feel like it was just, like, the Catholic... Like a Catholic church or the community in general was picketing to the point... there's some funny stories about, you know, obviously you've probably heard Kevin Smith joined the protesters one day in disguise, not necessarily in disguise, but pretending to be, you know, upset about the movie. And then the...
They held a counter-protest at some point. With just a few of them out there, I think.
The Catholic League that protested it.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. I do feel like... Because I know that Kevin's definitely had some interactions with the Westboro Baptist Church,
They would get upset about anything, though, so it could have been any of his movies, really.
True.
That might have been for Red State or something.
Oh, yeah.
You might be right, actually.
That would make sense for Red State, because that's kind of...
True.
Cultish in a little bit.
And then there was, like, the leader of that group, I think you said the Catholic League... requested a copy of the movie so that they could, like, intelligently, like, object to it. And Kevin Smith was like, well, what have you been doing up to this point? Because...
Yeah. Like, well, the thing was, they contacted the head of Disney for it. They didn't actually contact Kevin Smith direct.
Yeah.
So, and the reason why they... And, like, Kevin Smith even said in an interview where they basically... Oh, yeah, they were contacting the head of Disney simply because... they wanted to make it newsworthy, whereas if they just tried to contact Kevin Smith, that's not newsworthy. So that's...
It
doesn't get the attention because it brings more attention to their cause because they're offended as Catholics. They're not... They were more worried about them being offended rather than it being offensive to the church.
Sure. Yeah. Have either of you seen... when I searched for this movie, it came up with something called In Defense of Dogma, and it was like Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, a 40-minute short film or documentary or something, I guess, talking about this movie.
No.
Does that sound familiar at all?
I haven't seen that.
Yeah, okay. We might have to look at that afterwards. Anyway, I guess we will move on to, does Dogma pass the internet relevancy test? And I kind of think it doesn't. Like, most of the things you see on the social media that involve Jay and Silent Bob specifically, I think they tend to be from Clerks 2. Mm-hmm. Because that's
Buddy
probably
Christ.
Like, that's probably the most high def thing. Yeah, Christ thing, I guess, has stuck around. It was a bit of a meme, wasn't it?
It still kind of is a bit of a meme. Like, you search for any like thumbs up GIFs or anything like yep. that, it still comes up with the Buddy Christ image.
Yeah, it's a very well designed sculpture. Yep. It definitely has just a it's a definitive look. You know, the point and the thumbs up and the wink. So I'm not surprised that sort of stuck around a bit. But yeah, I didn't find anything else particularly. I did a bit of a search around to jog my memory, but you know, no real GIFs.
Yeah, like if you type in dogma for a GIF search, you don't get a hell of a lot.
No.
I feel like Kevin, like Silent Bob holding up the $20 bill at the strip club or something could be like one that you could use for like presenting cash, but there's not a whole lot.
He does have such a good little grin on his face as he does his little dance.
This is probably the I guess aside from his monologue in Chasing Amy, this is probably the most involved that Silent Bob has been in one of the, well, I guess apart from Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back and Reboot, like in those 90s movies, he's got like the biggest role. He's got a couple lines in this movie, right? No Ticket, the great Indiana Jones throwback.
Yeah. No Ticket and Thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think exactly. This was really, well, this and in Mallrats, he sort of really started on the very cartoonish version of Silent Bob and Jay, of course. Definitely Clerks and Chasing Amy, they were almost just cameos or background sorts of things. So I think this was certainly the first one where Jay and Silent Bob were really main characters.
And tied into the plot, yeah.
And like tied essential. Into the plot, exactly. And obviously Jay and Silent Bob
Strike Back is
vital for that, but... yeah, I agree. It was probably the first time that he had such a major part.
Mm. All right. How would smartphones and social media change this movie? I don't know that they would. We mentioned that they didn't have any phones really at all. I think if they did, they probably would have realized that the town from the John Hughes movies was made up before they turned up in another state.
I just used the term maybe very strongly there because they are Jay and Silent Bob.
Yeah, true. What do you think, Benny?
In terms of, technology, like with the whole thing going to like organizing the buses for them and the train and all that sort of stuff where they're like, I think there's the scene at the bus stop before they meet Azrael. Where it's like, oh, you know, you should have organized this beforehand. Like, it's all stuff they could have done digitally these days.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, other than that, there's not really a huge amount. Like, the news could have been on a social media post or something like that. Maybe it would have been videos of these horrible events happening that these guys have caused. It's not detrimental to the story, but, like, just the way technology would interact with it today. Like, it probably would have changed a little bit.
Yeah, I don't think there was much plot stuff that would have been changed by it. You know, they might have had some of the news a bit sooner rather than having to see it on a TV in a bar or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I thought of is for Catholicism, wow, that they would have had like a huge social media campaign.
Yeah.
You know, they probably have like a Buddy Christ Twitter account that was run by them and you know, pumping out memes or something.
Yeah,
it seemed like a weird thing to get such big news coverage, like TV news coverage, and Dante Hicks. Is it Dante Hicks?
Yeah.
Who's the news reporter? Yeah.
It's the actor. Is he?
It's the guy that plays Dante.
Yeah.
And the guy that plays Randall. Brian, is the Brian O'Halloran.
I'm trying to think what his name is in this movie. I've got the.
Oh yeah. Oh
it's
yeah.
Grant, I think he's... sorry. It's Grant Hicks.
Or, right. Yeah. So presumably a relative.
Yeah, yeah. And he's like, well, there you have it. It's like such a classic like TV reporter in movies thing to
when
say.
You recognize it's him, though, it's like, just say you're not supposed to be here today.
I'm surprised they didn't throw that in there.
Yeah. But like, and then Randall's also the gun shop owner.
Yeah, you've got all the usual suspects here, as Ben
Janine
would know. Like,
Ruffalo shows up at the start of the... Planned Parenthood.
You've got Walter Flanagan, Brian Johnson, the guys that just seem to pop up in every movie.
Yeah, a couple of the protesters at the beginning.
Yeah,
Moshe's the guy that's making out with the woman on the bus. Yes. And yeah. Okay.
Not that it's any of your business.
So could you make Dogma in 2020, and what would that version look like?
I think you could make it in 2020 quite easily. Maybe fix a few of the plot holes up and stuff like that. But yeah, easily I reckon you could make it in 2020.
I feel like in 2020, Dogma would be like an Amazon Prime exclusive or something.
Oh, yeah.
And they just like make it even more brutal with some of the, you know, add some additional kind of ultra violence in there. Feels like that's
sort of... They turn it into a 10-episode series and, yeah.
Yeah. I was just thinking that a series would work really well with something like this. And it's a bit more cat and mouse going back and forth.
Mm.
Some twists and turns as they go on their quest to...
I think a good equivalent to not so much the direct, like, Dogma story, but a good equivalent to it would be Good Omens on Amazon Prime already.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because
it
kind of has that same heaven and hell thing
angels
going
and demons,
through it.
Yeah.
But instead of being two renegade angels, it's a renegade angel and a renegade devil together.
I feel like it'd be a cross between the two Amazon Prime originals, Good Omens, and then The Boys.
Yeah.
Where you sort of do have these off-kilter kind of, the renegade angels and some of the renegade superheroes, I guess, in The Boys. So.
Yeah, I haven't watched the Good Omens show, but they play the trailers for it all the time. And
You should watch it. I reckon it's
good. It's
really
good. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll give it a look in. The Steve Buscemi Spark Plug Award.
Steve Buscemi.
A real spark plug.
There's a couple nominees. I guess Alanis Morissette has her appearance as God. I actually thought Alan Rickman could be a nominee for this because he's not actually in a whole lot of the film. But every time he is, he's obviously a bit of a scene stealer. He's got so much presence as like a, you know, Shakespearean style kind of actor that... apparently, like that was what motivated Muse to learn his lines for once, and he ended up learning like every line in the whole movie.
Oh, that's right, I do recall that story. Everybody's lines.
Yeah,
yeah. And he got told off on set because he was mouthing the other people's lines,
right,
during scenes as well. And he was so mad at himself because he was disappointing Alan Rickman.
I mean, and why wouldn't you?
Yeah, it's Alan Rickman.
Forced to be reckoned with.
Hmm. And you mentioned Janine Garofalo. That's another kind of small role. She doesn't get much chance to do much with that. Mm. I think Kevin Smith actually said he wished he gave her that lead role after the trouble he had with Linda.
She would have been good, actually. I feel like that would have worked.
Yeah, really well. Yeah, I think she's got a bit more of the comedy background to have made that work. Not that I think there was anything wrong. Like, it kind of needed the straight person, the straight woman in that role next to Muse and whatnot, but I think we should give this to Alan Rickman. Great performance.
If he qualifies, then I definitely think.
Yeah.
Although along those lines, George Carlin as well.
That's a good point. That's a good point. I don't know, like who gets less
even
screen
Jason
time?
Jason Lee kind of falls in that sort of category.
Yeah, you're making some very good points here. I actually don't know who to give it to out of Rickman and Carlin.
I'd probably say, like, just because Rickman's got a bigger role in the film and a more integral role, I'd say Carlin because he's got a smaller role.
Yeah.
He is great.
Don't get me wrong. I absolutely love Rickman's performance in this. I think he's fantastic in his comedy timing on it's great. And the line at the bar is like, well, I guess we get drunk because I'm all out of ideas. It's still a good one. And he does the whole wax on, wax off at the end. I love everything that Alan Rickman does in this film, but I think Carlin gets it just for having the smaller role, but the bigger impact for such a small role.
Yeah, I think the thing with Alan Rickman's character is he has like some of the best dialogue in the whole thing. 100%. Like, he has so many great lines. It's like he's got that like the driest kind of like, I wish I didn't have to be here kind of, just the way he talks is
and I always love the way he leans on the F in fish in that first scene. What are you gonna hit me with? Like, you gonna hit me with that fish?
Yeah,
kills me.
Good. And Carlin, I know that was like a really big deal for Kevin Smith to get him in the movie. I think this is his last like performance before he died.
Oh wow.
No, because he's in Jersey Girl after this.
Oh, is he? Okay, with maybe Smith,
and he's in James Bond 2.
Sure. Yeah. Maybe I just read that his last, like his Kevin Smith was, a Kevin Smith movie may have been his last
role.
It might have
been his cameo in, might have been Jersey Girl then. Anyway,
he gets the award, so congratulations, George.
Mm.
Last question, is Dogma still a good movie? I'm going to say yes.
Yep.
Probably a tad too long. Maybe they could trim it down a little bit. It's over 2 hours, which is, I feel like, is, unless you're making a Judd Apatow movie, it's always a little bit too much. But yeah, I think generally it holds up.
Yeah, I think you're right. Trim some of the fat. And that's a curse of some of Kevin Smith's film and writing as well, is because he has some of these long dialogue scenes as well. Some of that could have been just trimmed up a little bit just to expedite things a bit better. But overall, I think it's still a very good film. Very entertaining film anyway.
I agree. It held up a lot better than I remembered or expected it to, based on not having watched it in probably a decade. I definitely agree. You know, it's got some good drama in there. It's got a good, interesting plot. The cast is fantastic. You know, there's still that element, obviously, of Smith's kind of playing around with his friends, but in the context of this much larger, interesting story. So,
I think the performances are all pretty good. There's a few times where Salma Hayek's acting is kind of like, I don't know, maybe it's just who the character is. I don't know. But generally, everyone does a really good job.
And actually, I'd written here that after Bartleby's change of heart, when he sort of has his little epiphany, Ben Affleck just starts eating up that role. He's just having so much fun with it and over the top.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
The moment when he's like in front of God and he's like, I'm sorry. Like, I did like that kind of, is it pathos? I don't know. Whatever. Catharsis. It's one of those words anyway. What's going on around 8-Bit? So BitStorm obviously is pumping out week to week. Ben, is there anything you want to plug with that?
Yeah, I am editing. I'm going to finish the edit tonight. I'm not sure when this episode comes out, but by the time it does, we will have put out episode 200.
Woo!
So we've hit that big milestone.
It's awesome, man.
So we've sort of done a bit of a bumper episode. It's an hour and a half episode. We actually did some really, really fun games. So for those who don't know, that's a comedy improvised game design podcast.
It's a good show. You should listen to it. I've been on it. It's hella lot of fun being on it as well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
absolutely. I want to be on it again, actually. I should hit you guys up.
Yes, you should. Come on.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
And Benny, you've got an 8-Bit cast episode that's probably not too far away, but in the works.
I've got some stuff in the works for 8-Bit cast. I did an 8-Bit cast recently with the boys from a couple of NPCs. Go check it out. Actually, really, I even listened back to it myself and went, man, this was a really good, fun, just chill out chat. So definitely worth a listen. Still doing some other stuff around the 8-Bit network. We've got the Twitch live streams coming up. I don't know if this episode will be out before that.
This will be out on Wednesday this week.
So. Wednesday this week? Oh, so yeah, it'll be out before the next community game night, which I think is October 23rd, if I've got my Fridays correct. I think it's 23rd. Anyway, twitch.tv/weare8bit. Brendan 8-Bit will be hosting it. I'm going to go around to his place and we're going to be having some fun and playing some games. I think most of we're going to be playing a little bit of Fall Guys and maybe some new Jackbox Party Pack and stuff like that. So if you get a chance, jump on, have a laugh with us, come hang out.
Yeah, that'd be good. And you've just had a really great episode of The Hungry Game Show too. So congrats on not coming last.
We won't
spoil. I was going to say we won't spoil what your score was, but I will say. Congratulations. And of course, you can catch me on Putting In Work podcast, and you can support this podcast with your ratings and reviews in podcast services of choice, especially Podchaser, to, you know, get some of that traffic over to Ben's daytime
appreciate
gig.
Plug.
Mm. Oh, yeah, definitely.
Just if you really want to support all three of us, you can head over to the Patreon at patreon.com/weare8bit, A-T-E-B-I-T. Kick in a few dollars a month and keep the emotional lights on, as we like to say. Where can we catch you on social media, Ben?
So you can find me on at Twitter, just Ben_Slinger, or Bitstorm at Bitstormcast. And also our Podchaser page is podchaser.com/Bitstorm.
Very good. And Benny?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at TheSpawny13, and all complaints in regards to my comments on this episode, forward them to at Brendan8bit.
Fantastic. And you can catch me on all socials at Johnny himself. But for now, thank you again for joining us, dear listeners, on Comedy Rewind. Be kind.
Stay hungry.